Welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I am your host, John Ebersole, and I am delighted to be joined today by the poet Mary Ruffel, whose latest book of poems is Trances of the Blast, published by Wave Books. Mary Ruffel's poetry sneaks up on you as if you're standing at night on Main Street, admiring a coat in the storefront. And then suddenly something grabs your head, yanks it back, and exposes your throat to the moon and stars. And as if years pass, she releases you. And after you brush yourself off, you're never the same again as you walk away. Mary Ruffel, welcome to New Books and Poetry.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks. Before we get into Trances of the Blast, I was wondering if we could rewind quite a bit and tell us a little about where you grew up and what your childhood was like.
Well, I had the misfortune of being born into a military family, which means that we didn't, I call it a misfortune for a number of reasons. Primary among them is the fact we had no control over where we lived or how often we moved. And I can't say I'm really from anywhere because I moved either every 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years would be the longest time we stayed in one place from the time I was born until I was 18. But then I settled more or less in the state of Vermont, and I have lived here on and off for 40 years and certainly do not have enough time left on Earth to, I could never live anywhere else for as long as I've lived here, even if I were to permanently move tomorrow.
This is absolutely true. Can you?
Well, you asked about the past, and I brought you up to the present. I moved around a lot as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I was once, this little anecdote will sum it up, I was taking a linguistics course in college, and the linguistics professor, who was amazing, on the first day had everyone, he went around the room, and I think you only had to say your name, maybe you had to speak one complete English sentence, and he could listen to you, and he could tell you where you were from. And he was uncannily accurate. And when he came to me, he asked me to repeat the sentence.
Oh, my gosh.
And I had to repeat it. And he said, he looked at me and said, "You are not from any one particular place. I hear in your voice the influences of all the major regions in the country."
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. He nailed it. Yeah.
He totally did. And what was the last, can you remember when your, did your father eventually retire, I guess? Were you already?
Eventually, he did retire, and eventually he died.
And where did he spend his last days?
Florida.
Florida, really? Did you ever live there?
Pensacola, Florida. Pardon me?
Did you ever live there?
No, I never lived there. I was long gone from home by the time they settled, retired in Florida, but obviously I visited them.
Yes. And when you were talking about the linguistics class, sorry to interrupt, what college were you attending?
I went to Bennington College.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you were in Vermont, huh? Yeah. And did you follow, and we'll get to the point where poetry really kind of took hold of you. But let me ask you, when did poetry in earnest kind of find you and latch onto you, and you started writing poetry?
Well, I know when poetry found me, but I don't know, I cannot pinpoint when it found me in earnest. To quote that phrase you used, I don't even know most days if it has yet found me in earnest, but it found me at a very young age. I would say poetry found me at the age of 7.
Is that a weird way to put it? It finding you? Is that some sort of like...
No, not at all. No, it's much more accurate than me finding it. It found me. It found a way into my life, and by two things. Anthologies of poems for children, which I fell in love with and devoured and had to own and keep in my room and read there as a lonely child. And it found me via the proverbial elementary school assignment. Today, boys and girls, everyone's going to write a poem, which was probably more prevalent then than now. But being asked to write it in school and reading it, it found me. It didn't find me in, it found me in a very different way when I was in junior high and could read full-fledged poems in the English language intended for adults.
Right.
I mean, that changes everything. I actually can, I can remember, I think I wrote about this in one of my essays, but I can't remember, I'll tell you anyway. I was in junior high. My sister was in college. She came home for the summer. I'd had a knee operation. My leg was in a cast, so I couldn't go outside and play the way I normally would. She was in the basement ironing, and she had a book from an English class, and it was the British Romantics. Now, either she gave it to me to read, or she read a poem from it, that I do not remember. All I can remember is being in the basement, her at an ironing board, my leg in a cast, and my life being changed forever when I think I was reading Shelley.
It's such a wonderful image to picture you, wounded, essentially, and poetry, like, now I got her, she can't even escape me.
Wounds on wounds on wounds.
They're like totally piled
on. It was Ozymandias, I think.
Yeah.
If that's how you pronounce the title of that great poem, which has, to this day, has such a special place in my heart and mind.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I think about you, the way you come across the page is very, very solitary, and I was surprised to, I don't know anything about your biography, so I was surprised to hear about your sister suddenly. Did you have any other siblings, or was she your only sibling?
No, there were three children, your typical American nuclear family. I have a brother as well as a sister. They're both older.
And so, yeah, being the youngest, was that, did that distinguish your childhood in any way? I mean, it's kind of a cliche to think about, like, oh, you were the youngest.
I think people have devoted their lives to studying this, you know, placement of the child, birth order, and all of that. The only child, the youngest, the oldest, the middle. Of course it did. Of course it did. There are fewer photographs of the youngest child because, and there were no baby books or photographs because by the time the youngest one came along, nobody cared anymore. But you're also, being the youngest, you're surrounded by twice as many people.
Really?
You know, when you're the firstborn, there's just you and your parents.
I never thought of it that way. I am the youngest person in my family as well. I was the youngest. And I also remember having to, like, look up a lot and like, because everyone was so much taller. And and it was almost like these disembodied faces constantly floating around me. It was really weird. And it reminds me, I was thinking there was some birth order book or something that was talking about the family. And it was interesting. There's always kind of the sibling that's the, or somebody in the family that's like the savior. And then there's somebody who is always the scapegoat who gets blamed for everything. And then there's always the lost child. And I'm wondering if sometimes the youngest child is, and winds up being the lost one. Like, everyone's exhausted by the time they get to the youngest. Interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. And the youngest is often creative.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking recently to someone who is the fifth child of six children, and they were bemoaning this fact because it was a number nobody cared about to be the fifth of six children. And I thought about it, and my heart went out to this person because it what utter unluck is that?
I know. Every family, you can't escape the strangeness and dysfunction of them. It's really incredible. Did you follow the traditional trajectory that seems common for young poets now and went through through an MFA program for poetry?
No, I did not.
Mm-hmm.
I came of age at a time where there were, first of all, only a handful of MFA programs, and it was not considered, well, in my mind, de rigueur or necessary to follow that route. So sometimes I deeply regret it, and other times I think it's the best thing I ever did, depending on what day you talk to me. But after college, this is a long, boring story, but basically I was writing fiction, well, what I thought was fiction or prose. And I did, in fact, I got an MA at Hollins College in Virginia, which is now Hollins University and has an MFA program, but in those days they simply had a brief MA program, and all of my peers, the group, incoming group that year afterwards, they just went on to MFA programs.
Interesting.
And I remember thinking, you're insane. You're a writer, and shouldn't you just go write? Aren't you tired of school?
Right.
And it was incomprehensible to me at that time. It no longer is incomprehensible to me, but at that time I was very stubborn, and or maybe I was just thinking out of the box. I don't know, but I never did, and I made the switch that year. I think I had a scholarship or a fellowship in fiction, but I never wrote any fiction. I wrote poetry, which I had always written, as soon as I was there. Anyway, long story short, I sent a quote-unquote story to a magazine, and I got a letter back, and the letter said, this was the summer after college, before I did the MA year, and the letter said, dear Miss Ruffel, we regret to inform you we do not publish poetry. It was very interesting. I took the same piece without any changes and sent it to a poetry magazine, and it was accepted.
So that was kind of a pivotal awakening.
It really was, because I said, oh, I get it. Okay, all right, you know. And, you know, these were pieces with right flush margins.
Right.
And then over the years, I had many of these pieces. And if you look at my first, I don't know how many books, there's always a very strange, odd, misplaced piece of quote-unquote prose stuck in there. And I think up through Cold Meridian, and then everything dawns very slowly on me. And then I realized, hey, I should pool all these pieces and not publish them in books of poems and publish them as a volume unto themselves. And that ended up to be my book, The Most of It.
Right. And so I wanted to ask you about writing prose compared to poetry. It's kind of a cliche question, but do you Do you sense, because I write both, and I sense there does seem to be a different energy going on. I find that I get angrier when I'm writing prose, like I'll have to walk away from it, that I don't sense in poetry. Do you find that you react to your writing differently when it's prose or poetry?
Yes, you're absolutely right, and I've never thought about it, but I have those same feelings. When I'm writing a poem, for better or for worse, I'm in my own little world, and I'm very, very happy to be there. And it makes absolutely no difference to me if later on someone wants to join me there or not.
Right.
I really could care less. I mean, I'm happy if they want to, but I'm not unhappy if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. With prose, I have much more of a sense of audience.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I do. I have much more sense of a purpose that is not only interior, and I get frustrated. I feel like more of a failure and have to walk away. Yeah.
I'm sympathetic to that. I was just working on a paragraph. I remember just the other day from like 8:30 or 9 a.m. and I worked on it, and my eyes always feel like they're starving when I write prose. And then I ended that entire, it was just like a paragraph trying to untangle a thought. And by 12 o'clock, I just gave up and ditched the whole thing. And it was so depressing. But with poetry, it seems to be a more, I don't know, the exchange between what's the interior and then the articulation seems much more forgiving and playful. And the prose just brings I think, like you said, frustration and anger. But I still, I don't know why. I guess I still enjoy that in some weird way.
When I have to write a poem, when I'm moved to write a poem, meaning the pressure from within, I will stop whatever I am doing.
Right.
I will not do absolutely necessary things that must be done. In terms of triaging activities, when a poem comes, it's instantly in first place.
Do you? It's like impossible to manage your time, right?
It is. But prose, for instance, right now, ever since last night, I want to write a little prose piece. I know exactly in my mind, more or less, what it's going to be, quote,
mm-hmm.
unquote, about. And I will put this off. It scares me.
Yeah.
It scares me. So I will put it off and I will eventually write it, but not today. You know what I mean? So I hadn't thought of that, but I do approach them differently, I suppose.
Yeah. And, that's interesting. I wonder if anybody has an inner propulsion to write an essay and needs to drop everything. I'm not sure.
I'm sure. No, I'm sure. And that's a sign to them that is their calling.
I think
I'm
that's
sure
right. I know. Do you ever think, I don't know. Sometimes I think writers are given this act of writing and their love for writing and their need to write as like probably the only gift this universe has thrown at them, and how like it takes a while sometimes to recognize or to be humble enough to accept that gift. Have you ever found that in the beginning when you started writing, somehow it was, you resisted it?
Well, I think the real gift is being alive.
Yeah.
And I think that writing is an acknowledgement of that other gift. And it very often takes a boy or girl a long, long time to acknowledge the first primary gift of life itself.
I think that is so true. That is amazing that you said that. And I think, too, that your work is pretty much often... And you're not kind of shy about this. It's just an articulation of that totality of the bewilderment of just being alive. It's just like such a preposterous state of affairs that you're that you get to wake up every day and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm Mary. Hi. You know, like, I'm going to be Mary Ruffo all day again today. So yeah, that's pretty incredible. Tell me about,
I don't put it exactly like that when I wake up.
You don't?
I don't call myself by my own name.
I'm just kidding.
But it's a delightful image.
Like, you wake up and you're like, oh my gosh, here I am. I'm Mary. I got to do this all over again today.
Yeah.
Let me ask you
real another quick. Another day.
Definitely. How did your relationship with Wave Books develop? They're a pretty extraordinary press. I was wondering how your relationship started with them.
My relationship with them started through my editor, Joshua Beckman, who I was giving a reading in New York, and I was introduced. Joshua was there, and we were introduced. And it was the first time I had sort of come out of the closet as an erasure artist. I had been making these books for many years, but I had never read aloud from one at a reading.
Oh, wow.
And I was giving a regular poetry reading, and I read aloud from an erasure book.
Mm-hmm.
And Joshua was in the audience and was very much interested in it and asked to see the book. And very shortly thereafter, he was hired by Wave to become one of their editors. And he contacted me about the possibility of them bringing out an erasure book. That's how it started. And in fact, A Little White Shadow, the only erasure book that's been published, was my first publication with Wave.
Were you really excited when somebody showed interest in that?
I cannot even put into words my feeling. It was unspeakable to watch Joshua read that little book, and I could tell from his face that he got it and was into it. And I had been very, very shy about these things, which were piling up all over my apartment.
Yeah. And
my meeting Joshua and later joining Wave, having them bring the erasure out, and then much later having them become my sole publisher, I consider one of the luckiest things that have ever happened to me in my life.
Oh, that is so sweet. Yeah, they are they're really great. And let me ask you about those erasures, because it's such a different engagement in a way with language that it's very tactile, and you're mixing your labor with the, I don't know, it sounds cliche, but like the materiality of the language. What kind of, I guess if we see writing off like poetry or writing it or composing it as like, you know, moments of self-forgetting, and I think stuff like craft and just making things and building things is also an act of self-forgetting, which to me at least is a tremendous respite from the usual anxieties of consciousness. Did you find that putting those erasures together were particularly like psychologically like healthy?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I liked what you just said about losing consciousness of the ordinary anxieties. When I work on an erasure, no, I'm making art. I'm in another world.
Yeah.
And this world, I have all the same feelings and sensations and that one does when one is writing a poem, or I'm sure it's the same for any artist, whatever he or she is making or putting together.
Mm-hmm. And
to get to
your latest book, Trances of the Blast, is there anything you know, intrinsically different, you think, about what you're up to in this book as opposed to your other books? I was reading recently about, been thinking about this, how a poet will often, by their second or third book, kind of find their kind of their common way of expression, and that they become who they really were supposed to become. Is there something anything different in particular about Trances of the Blast, or do you see it as a kind of a seamless continuation of your prior work?
I don't think I can answer that question because if my work changes over the years, I myself am not aware of it, although I can become aware of it when others point it out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not the sort of poet that I don't have, you know, projects for the next book. I very much admire a great many poets who do, but I don't.
Yeah.
I'm just not, I don't work like that. I don't set, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think this is a departure or a change? I'm unaware of it.
No, I think there is a consistency, a pretty solid consistency to your work from book to book. But what I think what you're saying is, and I find this, I think it's really like, it's really encouraging, I think, is that you're kind of, there's no sense of like codependency on the exterior world when you're writing your work. It's that, and maybe it takes a tremendous confidence or at least a strong sense of who you are to just kind of untether yourself and trust whatever, you know, whatever kind of voice or tone or word choice that occurs to you. And I think a lot of young poets in particular are kind of like, they're like multivocal in many ways. They, from poem to poem, they present sort of a different energy. And I think while your book certainly presents a multitude of energies, that I always feel the intimate connection that I'm speaking and listening to and interacting with the same sort of locus of production or creativity. So I would say that you're recognizable from book to book, which I think
I hear you, but that may have something to do with, I think a life becomes decompartmentalized as time passes. So when you're very young, I know this was true of when I was young, you have all these different spheres that you keep moving from one to the other.
Yeah.
You have your work life, your job. Then you have your life as an artist, your creative work. And then you have your family or your partnership or your relationship to the various close ones in your life. And then you have your community life or your home life, where you live, your apartment building, your neighbors, your roof break, whatever it is, and then you have your family, your birth family. And these are that's a lot of spheres orbiting around. And you move from one to the other. But if you're lucky, as time passes, well, I can't speak for everyone. I can only speak for myself. I realized over time, without being too conscious of it at the time, I realized later my whole life was one of decompartmentalization. I can't pronounce it anymore. I have very few compartments in my life right now.
I think
I just, you know, in other words, my world is my world, and it's one sphere, and there may be spheres within it, but they're all part of this one sphere, which is my life as an artist.
I think
my life. You know, first of all, eventually your birth family dies.
I mean,
your parents die.
Yeah.
And everything changes, there's not that. And then, once you reach a certain age, there are no more authority figures. That's a huge, huge change. No more authority figures. And you begin to concentrate on the one thing that makes you happy, oh, you know, it's paint what you want and die happy. That's a Henry Miller title. I love it. Paint what you want and die happy. And as artists, we should try, insofar as possible, to enact that in our lives. And as we come closer and closer to it, I think we might be less multivocal, as you say.
Yeah, I think that's really amazing and wise what you just said. And it used to, a long time ago, I talked to a poet who was very tentative about whether he was wanted to start a family one day, blah, blah, blah. And I always assumed it was just a matter of time management issues, like he would have to devote his time to elsewhere. But I think what you're saying is 10 times more profound, in that in each compartment of our lives resides this kind of a fear. And it's just a fear of whether losing or being misunderstood or whatever it is that, and I think it's right. I think it is fear, among other things. And if one has that kind of stacked boxes on one's shoulders all the time, to sit down and trust yourself as a creative artist is going to maybe be, there's going to be a lot of pressure on you in those moments of creation. And what comes out ultimately might be, like you said, maybe expressions of all those compartments of fear. And that's really incredible. I'm so glad you said that, because that is helpful to me and hopefully other people. I was hoping, Mary, we could go ahead and crack open Trances of the Blast and read a few poems out of it. How do you feel about that?
Oh, that'd be lovely. Yeah, let's do that.
All right. So I was hoping we could get to, and the book is just lovely. What do you think of this very Spartan design of the book? Wave has put out quite a lot of books now with this very, you know, it's not visually busy.
Well, that's their
book
signature look. They want, I think the idea behind that is they want a book to be easily recognizable as a Wave book.
Mm-hmm.
The way the old Black Sparrow books were all recognizable as Black Sparrow books, as one example. So, the books are very handsome, and, they're all black and white, and that's a conscious decision on their part.
Yeah,
they give a lot of thought to production.
Yeah, it's really beautifully done. I think the first poem I was hoping you could read is on page 11. Provenance.
In the fifth grade, I made a horse of paper mache and painted it white and named it Aurora. We were all going to the hospital, each one with his little animal, to give to the girl who was lying on her deathbed there, whose name I can't recall. A classmate with freckles, perhaps, or such small feet, her footsteps never mattered much. I did not want to give her anything. It seemed unfair. She got to ride Aurora, whom I made with my own two hands and took aside at birth and said, go, while I had to walk, perhaps for a very long time. I thought perhaps the animals would all come back together and on one day, but they never did. And so I've had to deal with wild, intractable people all my days, and have been led astray in a world of shattered moonlight and beasts and trees where no one ever even curtsies anymore or has an understudy. So I have gone up to the little room in my face. I am making something out of a jar of freckles and a jar of glue. I hated childhood. I hate adulthood. And I love being alive.
Mary, thank you so much. You know what really struck me about this poem is your, a lot of things did, but your constant use of the word perhaps in the beginning, that there was this non-committal kind of qualifier of perhaps, 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 and the attitude of the speaker towards this little girl on her deathbed is just mesmerizing. That it reminds me of, it just reminded me of this. I heard an interview with, the essay writer David Sedaris, and he apparently wrote some essay where he visited Anne Frank's house, and he ends the essay on actually gazing out her window and admiring the apartment across the street and how he would want to rent it, and how it just like totally undercut the historical importance of Anne Frank. And in a way, I get the sense with this speaker that she is kind of, it sounds like, made to go to this person in a hospital bed. And right there, it's just kind of like a little resentment. Now you're going to take something I made with my hands that I developed a relationship with. And then the poem takes this dramatic turn, and you say, and so I've had to deal with wild, intractable people all my days. And you just go from there, and it's just amazing. And then to end, I hated childhood. I hate adulthood. And I love being alive. Is there anything you want to say about this poem?
Well, it all really happened. It was a vague memory that sort of came back to me at some point in later life. But I was in the fifth grade, and we made these animals with paper mache. The entire class went to the hospital to visit a classmate who was dying there of cancer.
Oh, my God.
And we brought her the animals we'd made, and she had them all around her bed in her hospital room. And we had to give them away, and it was one of the first art objects I ever made. And yeah. I was rather attached to the horse.
Yeah.
But we had to give it to the girl. And then I really did think, this is a child's thought, she'll die, and we'll get the animals back. They'll give them back to us.
Right.
But she did die, but we never got the animals back.
Oh, my God.
And I was angry. I was a child, and the title provenance, of course, means that's a word it's most often used in the art world to trace the ownership of an art object.
Exactly.
So I don't know, but out of the blue, out of nowhere, this memory came back to me. I had forgotten it
for
a very long time. And I was very mad after the poem was published, because I remembered later that the horse's name was not Aurora. It was Arabella.
Isn't that funny?
But when I wrote it, I was sure I had remembered the correct name, Aurora.
Uh-huh.
And then out of the blue, walking across the floor one day, I stopped into my tracks and said, it was Arabella.
You like raised your fist up at the ceiling.
Arabella. But if you read the poem, of course, Arabella would sound horrible in it. I could never use Arabella. I couldn't replace Aurora with Arabella, because it would destroy the sound of the opening. I'd have to completely rewrite the first stanza to make Arabella work.
Yeah, Aurora just abducts the mouth when it shapes those sounds. It's incredible.
Aurora was Dawn, and it was the birth name of Cinderella in a lot of the versions of that folk tale or fairy tale.
Yeah, when you write...
Only a girl would know that. I'm sorry. We should get...
No, that's quite all right. We have a lot of girl listeners. When you write I Hated Childhood, that really... I don't know if you're being a little, a little half-sincere there, but it made me think... whenever I see... I learned how I sort of felt about childhood... Whenever I see children involved in a collectively staged activity, whether it's like a birthday party or at a school, they're asked to sing a song together. That one time I turned to a friend and I told him in so many ways, like, isn't this tragic? And he like turned to me and looked at me like I was a monster. And it really kind of got me thinking about childhood and children, the spirit of children populate and play around your poems often. I was wondering, do you have a particular take on childhood? I know the poem says you hated it, but can you speak to that at all?
Well, it's absolutely true. I hated childhood. That is a true statement, but an equally true statement is I loved childhood. First of all, the state of consciousness of a child mm-hmm. is a wondrous, wondrous thing and makes them incredibly resilient to whatever is going on around them. I mean, children who live in war-torn countries.
Right.
And who, I'm using that as an example, can still, you know, find a broken stick in the rubble, and even though they're starving, they'll play with it, you know.
Precisely.
I mean, that, and there's that side of childhood, and in that sense, all childhoods are happy, insofar as the basic consciousness of a child is geared towards being in the moment.
Yeah.
And, but on the other hand, there's the idea of the myth of a happy childhood. Children are terribly cruel to one another. Parents can be terribly cruel to children. And many children are misunderstood and lonely. And I had a very lonely, misunderstood childhood.
Right.
And I have some pretty devastating childhood memories, and I have some wonderful childhood memories that are full of life and joy and beauty and love. It's no different than adulthood.
Yeah, no, I always sense in your work, and I think when I introduced you, I had this sense of, I always sense that your poems are, there's an amicable quality to them that I always feel like is definitely veiling, I think, it seems to me a particular like traumas of childhood for some reason. And it was interesting that you said that you have some devastating and also good memories from childhood, but some devastating ones as well. And those,
yeah.
And those that occur in childhood are, you know, I heard an interview with the writer Barry Lopez, and he had a very traumatic experience as a child, and he was talking about it, and he wrote about it, I think. And he felt like something had been plucked from him that could never be replaced. And that I think many writers write into that place, whatever was taken. It's very fascinating. I was hoping we could, move on to another poem, and this one, is titled Fireworks on page 16.
Certainly. And before I read that, though, I want to respond to what you just said.
Of course.
I'm very fond of saying many people who are writers were very lonely children who found their first true comrades in books.
Indeed. Gosh, isn't that so true?
You find in a book someone who you sense instantly is a friend. Someone who's curious and someone who seems to be overwhelmed by life. Someone who's not afraid to print the words, I'm lonely. Someone who is full of joy over the simplest. You know, we find in novels and poems as children, but especially as adolescents and young adults, we find comrades and we find eventually our family.
Isn't that remarkably true? That is exactly my experience. And I'm glad you, by speaking to it, you yeah. definitely honor it. Whenever you're...
So, I'm going to read Fireworks now?
I would love if you did that.
Fireworks. The world was designed and built to overwhelm and astonish, which makes it hard to like. An American is someone who thinks Jan Vermeer is from Vermont and a woman. I am a woman from Vermont. Little less surprising than the copiousness of transpiration, which is so inconsequential, I cannot live without it. Later, I will look for a nail tearing on the floor, as if a maid were coming tomorrow. One always has to pick up first. Right now, I am writing on the back of a bank statement. My happiness is marred only by my failure to attain it. Otherwise, it would astonish and overwhelm. Quick, children, put on your robes. We must all go downstairs to see something. On this same night was Balthazar murdered by his servants. what the Russian soldier, quoting Hein, scratched on the wall in the room where the whole royal family was shot. Shot to fleshy pieces with many aims, at least 20 of which left explosive stars in the wallpaper. Their greed and power astonished all. Their death overwhelms us.
Mary, thanks for that. That is such a powerful poem. I'm just speaking of being overwhelmed and astonished. I was continually.
You can thank my editor for this poem being in the book because just when I was reading it, I recalled I had put that in the reject pile. That
Did
was
you?
Buried in the reject pile, and he found it and. Yeah.
It's actually one of my favorite poems in the entire book.
I'll pass that on to him and laugh. Because
please do. Because, one.
When I heard, you know, someone wanted to put that in the book, I said, you have to be out of your mind. it takes all minds.
The ending does have a pretty surprising burst of violence at the end that I didn't see coming whatsoever, and I don't see often in your work. But I do want to kind of back up a little bit and look at the repetitions of overwhelm and astonish. The world was designed and built to overwhelm and astonish, which makes it hard to like. And that to me is so big-hearted and a generous thing to say to your reader and a reader of poetry, because I think it's, you nail on something so, so utterly true there. And then further down in the poem, you say, my happiness is marred only by my failure to attain it. And then we see those two words emerge again. Otherwise, it would astonish and overwhelm. And the idea of astonishment and being overwhelmed kind of worked their way through this poem. And I kind of wrestled with that. You often bring up the word happiness in your poems. And in here, I kind of read it that for one to be happy, you must somehow like the unlikable, which the world is. And then in the end of the poem, you say, their greed and power astonished all, their death overwhelms us. And I thought you kept just, I imagine it like turning a safe lock over and over with those two words.
I think, I mean, at the end, obviously I'm referring to the last royal Russian family, Nicholas and Alexandra and their famous children who were so brutally murdered. And I use that as an example of how hard it is to think about anything from just one side or view. Or if you are, you're making a terrible mistake because, you know, I mean, in fact, you know, half the people in Russia were peasants.
Right.
They didn't have enough to eat, and the greed of some of those monarchies was unspeakably horrific.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they were human beings, and they were a family unit, and they loved each other, and they were like any other family. And the details of their death of I was, when I was much younger, became obsessed with Russian history and all of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the details of the last months of their life are equally horrific. It's, you know, they're inhumane and they're treated inhumanely. Who's innocent? Who's guilty?
Mm-hmm.
It is overwhelming. It's, I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, that's fine. And but, I wanted to think about in your... And I was hoping for you to speak to this because it's something that I often think about, that in our country in particular, the seeking of personal happiness is almost nearly pathologized or a fetish in many ways, that is the primary purpose of our time on Earth. And I don't know if that's due to the fact that many and most have abandoned any concept of eternity or a life after the one on Earth, that the stakes are so high on this one that one can only seek happiness here, where perhaps in pre-modern societies where the idea of suffering, which reminded one of death, was
kind of, a link in some, in short, it had some sort of meaningful divine purpose. And I noticed happiness comes up a lot in your poems.
Well, there's no such thing as unadulterated happiness. I mean, it doesn't exist. Happiness is not a goal that you reach and sustain. Only young people are foolish enough to believe that. There's still hope in it. Happiness is...
like, there's no finish line to it.
Great, many different things. You know, one of the things it is that being alive is enough. You know,
right.
that's can just acceptance. But it also is... it comes, many people write about this, it comes in flashes, and you recognize that it doesn't last, but it's a momentary light in the dark, and it's just a little spark, and it's like fireflies.
Indeed.
And sometimes there are a lot of fireflies in the field, and sometimes there's only one or two, and sometimes you have to wait for hours or days or months to see another one. I mean, happiness, I don't know how to talk about happiness, really. I know Wittgenstein said he didn't know why we were put on Earth, but he was pretty sure it had absolutely nothing to do with happiness. And I tend to agree with him.
Yeah.
I think happiness to an American means something very different than it means to someone in another part of the world. Ooh, no, wait, I can't say that. But anyway, no less in authority than the Dalai Lama himself has also said, and this is quoting him, there's a happiness is the purpose of Earth. There's nothing wrong with searching for happiness.
Yeah.
You know, so you put the Dalai Lama and Wittgenstein in a room and have them have a conversation. That is a conversation I would like to overhear.
I would definitely sit in on that conversation as well.
Yeah.
Move forward, let's take a look at your poem, Fall Leaf Studies. And are your fall leaves in Vermont still intact? I was just in Massachusetts, not too far from you, and that was about 3 weeks ago, and the leaves were literally just blowing up beautifully. Are they still attached to the trees?
They're half gone, up, half down. Some days it just rains leaves. So Fall Leaf Studies. Fall leaf studies. I wake up. I count my money. Then I have lunch. After lunch, I go to the window. The leaves are no longer green. When the leaves fall at the end of summer, who knows if there are enough to cover the ground? Do they themselves ever actually really know? They come down slowly and with many conjectures. After all that yak, and in that bronze state, they pause.
Thank you so much for that. I wanted to ask you about, you've lived in Vermont so long. Have you, and I know you've lived in many places, that it seems that the more, and I don't know anything about where you live, but is it rural and pretty naturalistic? And do you find that's pretty consistent with kind of your disposition and what's good for you? Have you ever lived in like New York City or an urban area? How did you discover Vermont was for you?
I was simply tired of traveling around after my childhood. So I went to college in Vermont and I just wanted to dig my heels in and not move. Again, I might have done things differently, had a different head been on my shoulders. I've never lived in an American city larger, but I've spent, I've taught in cities. I've never lived in a city the size of New York or LA. I used to live for many years out in the extreme country where you could make a statement you have no neighbors because you couldn't see them.
Yeah.
But those days are over, and actually where I live now is smack in the center of a very, you know, depressed New England, small, depressed New England town. I live in what's considered a bad neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I'm very fond of it because the people that I observe here are they're endlessly fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I did realize the other day that more and more and more neighborhood that I live in is cropping up in my poems. There are two poems in it, two or three in this new book. I'm trying to think of their titles. One is The Afternoon According to St. Matthew, and one is What Went Ye Out Into May?
Yes.
To See. And they both contain in them seen or heard things from the neighborhood I live in.
How do you feel, reading one of those?
Oh, one of those.
I don't know. You piqued my curiosity now.
Oh, well, perhaps the shorter would be better. Afternoon According to St. Matthew. Gotta find what page that's on. Give me a minute.
I will help you.
38 here.
You won. All right. Well, thank you so much for reading that. Did you want to say anything more about your neighborhood? I sort of cut you off in my excitement
to have you
read this.
Well, this poem has to do with there are two girls, two sisters. Oh, this is embarrassing. but I just like to watch. And I have a window in a little kitchen area. And when I look out the window, I'm looking directly. These houses are very close together. I'm looking at a driveway where maybe three or four different generations live in a very, very tiny, tiny house. And I had tried to figure out who belongs to who.
Right.
And I can't do it. But needless to say, there's some hard scrabble times. And
gotcha.
I have had a lot of fights. And I've watched these little girls play for years and years, and in fact, the little girl who's the little girl, the littlest girl in the poem I'm about to read is, she's now like junior high or something, but
wow.
None of that, of course, matters because this is just my imagination. But The Afternoon According to St. Matthew, there's the black truck with orange flames on its hood. There's the girl in the pink pajamas. There's her sister in a bumblebee suit. They're playing with dirt. When they find bugs, they scream, but no one hears them. Their minds are growing, though. In the late afternoon light, they scoop the dirt into tin cans so they can bury it in the backyard. I think we have a case of two women grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. But it's way too early to tell.
Oh, thank you so much for reading that. That is so remarkable. That is so remarkable. And I can't. Have you ever interacted with them in any sort of mundane way?
No, I've never even spoken to them. I've just watched them. But I really did one day see them. I mean, you know, burying dirt.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things. I buried things as a child, but you bury things. But you bury dirt. You move dirt from one place to another.
I know. Isn't that incredible?
Maybe that's not what they were doing, but that's what my imagination. I mean, that's what it looked like they were doing, and I have to die believing that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I don't know if this is kind of a romantic notion, but you seem to have a felicity towards like an authenticity that the way you remembered the horse, the papier-mâché horse's name and little moments of accuracy that are important to you. Can you speak to that for a second?
My memory is primarily visual.
Yeah. And then you just kind of like reproduce that, right?
I remember in images.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day who claims that they absolutely think in images, that language rarely
enters any sort of interior monologue. I don't know how to think about that.
Oh, but they're not a writer, are they? They couldn't be.
No, they're not. They're not a writer.
Yeah. No, I very much, I think in language.
Me too.
My interior monologue is in language. It's not in complete sentences, obviously.
Right.
And then there are images that flash on and off, come in and out. Woven together are images and words, images and words. But primarily I think of myself as thinking in words, but memory is always the image first.
That is so true. And I think you described the interior actions of the mind, like, really perfectly. I think we're going to go out with one more poem, Mary, Elegy for a Game.
All right. Elegy for a Game. Once I was on Earth, and I liked it. I got to look at my toes underwater. They looked bigger than they were in real life. As anyone can tell by looking at it, sugar is meaningless. You're not supposed to stay in the hot tub longer than 10 minutes. After that, it is meaningless. Like white poinsettia. I mean at Christmas. Maybe Christmas is meaningless too, but we used to pretend it was not, and I liked that. It's pointless. I don't actually know what a football looks like. I think they have something to do with babies. The man is carrying a baby across the field. He is trying to save it. It's hard. Sometimes people die trying to do things. That's okay. There are things more important than life or death. I miss holding my breath.
Mary Ruffel, thank you so much for joining us on New Books and Poetry.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.